Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Jack Hennessy, a trustee of the Manhattan Institute, and I have the pleasure of introducing our guest speaker today. Education and education reform has been fundamental to the Manhattan Institute since its very beginnings. And just yesterday we had a very inspirational breakfast on faith-based learning, which the Manhattan Institute sponsored. But programs such as those undertaken by the Center for Educational Innovation, vouchers, school choice, charter schools, either the original idea or the promotion of the idea can be traced back to its roots here at the Manhattan Institute. Today, we have the pleasure of a speaker who was also a pioneer in education. 27 years ago, Dennis Keller founded something called the Keller Graduate School of Management in 1973. In those days, and even today, I think many people thought that for-profit education was an oxymoron, if not a dirty word. It just couldn't be. Well, fortunately, over the last 27 years, Dennis has proved that that is absolutely false. He's chairman and CEO of DeVry, Inc., which owns and runs the DeVry universities, and also Becker Kornweiser, the CPA firm which graduates half the world's CPAs. But Dennis has a very, very strong dedication and involvement in education. He's a graduate with a degree in economics from Princeton University. He holds an MBA from the University of Chicago. And he's on the university, he's chairman of the University of Chicago's Business Council. He's chairman of Princeton's School of Engineering and Science, and very, very active in many other aspects. I'm going to let him tell the story about the great story about DeVry today, but I want to just highlight a couple of things because I think they're really important. There are 80,000 students being educated as we speak in DeVry, Inc., through DeVry universities and through Becker. I think that's more, Dennis, argue with me, than Harvard, Princeton, Yale, and a few others all added together. There are 35 countries. We had the pleasure of Credit Suisse First Boston to take them public in 1991. Today's equivalent price, correcting for splits, the price at the IPO was $1.25. Today it's at $25. Better than an internet stock. But Dennis is also morphing into an internet distant learning company. You'll hear all about it for him, but let's give a hearty welcome to Dennis Keller.
Thank you very much, Jack, for a very kind introduction, especially given our venue and how nicely you treated Princeton and your own background. I'm thrilled. And I thank all of you for the opportunity to talk with you today because the Manhattan Institute is one of our nation's leading public policy forums, so I'm very honored by this invitation. I'm also happy because it gives me a chance to check in on our New York City campus, which is just across the Queensboro Bridge in Long Island City. It's one of the newer campuses in our system, and its first graduating class will be receiving their degrees in June. I'd like to talk with you today about one of our country's most important, or the world's most important public policy issues, the role of post-secondary education in society and in the economy. Our collective investment in intellectual capital is fundamental to America's ability to maintain its role as a global economic and democratic force. That's not news to you. You're all up to your ears in that one way or another. That's why you're here. But my remarks are intended. I'll do my best, but I hope we'll have questions afterward because I'm sure I'm not going to hit everybody's target, to give you a preview of the university of the future. Charles Kettering, who lived in the town that, for a while anyway, that I grew up in Hinsdale, Illinois, and was an electrical engineer and an inventor and an important piece of General Motors' early years, said, and this surprised me when I when I learned this and read this, but I'm going to give it to you exactly the way I found it. We should all be concerned about the future because we have to spend the rest of our lives there, and I always thought Yoga Berra said that. I've always admired Yogi. I couldn't imagine he'd plagiarize. I couldn't. But anyway, one should always issue caveats when making predictions because all too often the future just doesn't turn out the way we had envisioned it. And any of you who participated in your NCAA basketball tournament office pool know exactly what I mean. So it's always good to remember the cautionary words of that other great philosopher, the movie mogul Samuel Goldwyn, who said, never make forecasts, especially about the future. So to set the stage for our discussion of the University of the Future, let me take a couple of minutes just to tell you a little bit about DeVry. DeVry Inc. is one of the largest publicly owned educational companies in the world. We provide career-oriented, regionally accredited collegiate degree programs in technology and business and professional examination preparation. We serve, as Jack told you, approximately 80,000 students at more than 300 locations in 35 countries through DeVry University and the Becker Kahnweiser CPA Review. DeVry University includes 17 DeVry Institute campuses from coast to coast in the U.S. and Canada. It includes Denver Technical College, which we acquired a year ago with campuses in Denver and Colorado Springs, and it includes 36 Keller Graduate School of Management sites across the country, including our Keller Online Center. DeVry's recognized leadership in technology-related education and its attention to student needs and its close relationships with employers over decades makes graduates of DeVry a very hot commodity in the marketplace. At our undergraduate DeVry Institutes, where we internally audit and publish our placement statistics every semester, and we do that three times a year because we have three four-month semesters year-round. Over the past 12 months, past three graduating classes, 96% of our graduates who actively sought employment, and over 90% of them do, as opposed to going on to graduate school or something else, are at work in their chosen field of study within 6 months of receiving their degree. We cut it off there and measure it. 96% are working in their field within 6 months of graduation, most of them, of course, right after graduation. So we are really proud of that record, and to my knowledge, we are the only system of undergraduate bachelor's degree granting institutions in that part of our university that publishes that data on bachelor's degree graduates. All DeVry programs blend theory with practice, and students benefit from our faculty's industry experience and also from applying their knowledge in up-to-date computer, electronics, and telecommunications laboratories. The blend of hands-on lab experience with general education courses produces well-rounded graduates who are prepared for the challenges and the changes in a lifelong career. DeVry University offers a quality education at a great price, about half the average tuition at other private colleges and universities. As a teaching-based institution, there's no research agenda that can balloon our costs or detract from serving the needs of our students. DeVry University is accredited by the North Central Association of Colleges and Schools, one of the six regional collegiate accrediting entities that accredit traditional colleges and universities throughout the United States. Our students qualify for the same federal and state financial assistance programs that are offered to students at other quality institutions of higher education. I believe DeVry has many of the characteristics of the evolving University of the Future, but I'll get to that in a minute. First, to get a glimpse at the University of the Future, let's look at some social and economic trends that are already changing the face of higher education, as well as other things that are having their faces changed. I believe there are at least seven major trends in post-secondary education relating to demographics, market forces, and technology that we should look at. The seven trends are as follows, and then I'll tell you a little more about them. First, steadily rising demand for post-secondary education around the world, especially here. Acceptance of the need for lifelong learning, true acceptance. We've talked about it for a long time, but people are starting to believe. Three, the knowledge economy or the information economy, as you all hear about. Four, globalization. Five, the internet explosion. Six, the use of private investment capital in higher education. And seven, the increasing diversity of our population. The first trend is the increasing demand for post-secondary education, which is being driven to a great extent by the demographics and by economics. The U.S. Department of Education predicts that the number of graduating high school seniors will increase by 20% during the coming decade. That's explained in large part by what's called the baby boom echo, the offspring of the generation of Americans who were born between 1946 and 1964. According to the American Demographics magazine, the echo boomers include 72 million people between the ages of 5 and 22. At the same time, the percentage of those high school graduates from the generation that are seeking post-secondary education has also been increasing. 20 years ago, 50% of high school seniors went on to post-secondary education within a year of high school graduation. Today, the figure is north of 65% in just 20 years. Why is that? The primary motivator is the growing wage gap in our new economy between those who have a college education and those who don't. The wage gap has widened from 50% in 1980, not that long ago, to an estimated 111% difference today. That widening salary gap relates to our second trend in higher education, lifelong learning, or continuous learning, as it's sometimes called. The traditional concept of completing one's education in the years immediately following high school has been replaced with the concept of lifelong learning. The traditional 18 to 24-year-old full-time student is in the minority now. Of 16 million plus college and university students today, only about 7 million are full-time, and many of those full-timers are 25 and over. In fact, of the entire 16-plus million, people over 25 represent nearly half, up from 28% 30 years ago. Non-traditional students are going back to school because they realize that there will be a severe economic disadvantage for them without additional education. As Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan has said, human skills are subject to obsolescence at a rate perhaps unprecedented in American history. Our economy's increasing reliance on knowledge assets and information technologies influences the kind of higher education these students look for, and it's the third of our seven trends. 80% of net job growth in today's economy occurs in information-intensive sectors such as network engineering, systems analysis, telecommunications, etc., etc., etc. The U.S. Department of Labor projects that the number of jobs for computer systems analysts and programmers will approximately double in the 10-year period ending in 2004, just 4 years from now. In 1970, approximately 5% of corporate capital expenditures were for computer and data processing equipment. The Commerce Department reports, and by 1997, 3 years ago, about nearly half, of capital expenditures by corporations were IT or information technology related. Personal computers are well on their way to being as commonplace in American homes as telephones and microwave ovens. Gartner Group estimates that internet penetration will hit 55% of American households by the end of this year, up 9 percentage points during the 12-month period. An international data corporation projects that e-commerce will reach $400 billion by the year 2002, up from $8 billion in 1998, 4 years prior. Economic wealth is increasingly being created by knowledge rather than by manual labor. Merrill Lynch has produced an outstanding resource on the evolving education marketplace. Many of you may have seen it. The Book of Knowledge is what they've called it. And Merrill Lynch says, the advent of the personal computer, the internet, and the electronic delivery of information have transformed the world from a manufacturing, physically-based economy to an electronic knowledge-based economy. Whereas the primary resources of the physically-based economy of 1900 were coal, oil, and steel, the resources of the new knowledge-based economy are brain power and the ability to acquire, deliver, and process information effectively. Computer literacy is the second language of the new economy. Leaders from the world, this is not a quote any longer, of traditional higher education see things in much the same light. The late Michael Hooker, chancellor of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, till his death last year, was asked not too long ago about the forces that will change education. He replied, quote, "The dominant force driving change in education in the coming years will be the further development of a knowledge-based economy. The economic success of a country or a region will depend on the quality of its intellectual capital." At the same time our economy is being transformed by information technology, it is also being transformed by increasing international commerce. Globalization of the economy is the fourth major trend affecting higher education. In this globalized economy, countries that don't have skilled knowledge workers will see the best jobs lost to countries that do. As Merrill Lynch reports in its Book of Knowledge, our post-secondary institutions are the best in the world. They have an opportunity, even a responsibility, to ensure that adults in the U.S. have access to the ideas that have made our economy so powerful, unquote. So just as information technology and the easing of trade barriers have created new opportunities and methods for conducting business among nations, this globalization also means tremendous growth opportunities in higher education. As Chancellor Hooker also said, quote, "English has become the international language, which creates global markets for education in English, both at the K-12 level as well as in higher education." So we will see the development of gargantuan markets dwarfing anything that ever existed before in education, unquote. Technology and the internet are not just shaping the economy and the workplace. They're also changing the way in which education is delivered. Online delivery of higher education represents the fifth trend having an impact on post-secondary education. Call it distance learning, distributed learning, online education, or the virtual university, whatever you call it, it's big. And yet, it's nothing compared to what it's going to be. It shows how higher education is moving in the direction of meeting the needs of students first, rather than the needs of the institution. Despite all the dazzling technology being used today, distance education has been around for a long time. It began with correspondence schools. In other cases, faculty members traveled to remote locations to teach. The idea has always been to provide an education to those who might not otherwise have access to it. And that's still an important goal today with distance learning. But new technologies allow much more sophisticated ways of providing this learning at a distance, including text, audio, video, images, links to other sources of knowledge, and it's only beginning as the pipes get bigger and bigger. So it's not just geographical access that's the goal today, it's access in a much broader sense. The role of distance learning has grown more important as educational institutions focus more attention on serving the lifelong learner. Online education gives students the flexibility to learn at times in their week and times in their lives that are convenient for them. Stephen Crow is Executive Director of the Commission on Institutions of Higher Education at the North Central Association of Colleges and Schools. That's the body that accredits colleges and universities headquartered in the 19 states of Middle America, including DeVry. Dr. Crow puts it this way, quote, "The fact is that the business of higher education is changing significantly, and technology has a large role in that shift. Distance learning has become a very visible home for new technological tools designed for a larger, more diverse student body. More precisely, online education has come to represent the shift from teacher-centered to learner-centered education," unquote. More and more institutions are experimenting with distance education, both traditional public and private not-for-profit institutions, as well as those funded by private investment capital. We're seeing a lot of partnerships between different kinds of institutions and private companies to collaborate both on content and technology. Institutions take varying approaches, with some offering all content and instruction online, and others blending the online content and instruction with personal interaction among faculty and students. There's still a lot of questions surrounding virtual universities. Will they, in fact, cut costs for students and institutions? Who owns the content? Who is the faculty? How do you ensure quality? All kinds of questions. The College Board issued a report last year raising the concern that online universities may actually widen the gap between the educational haves and have-nots. Another huge and important question. That's because of the so-called digital divide, which generally refers to the lack of computer and internet access and capabilities among people who are socially and economically disadvantaged. There are many questions being raised about virtual learning in this and other regards in our post-secondary education system. But whether the learning is delivered through a computer or face-to-face in a classroom, there are always the fundamental questions about affordability and access both to students and the society as a whole, and online has an enormous amount to offer in answering those questions more universally in the months and years to come. So, how will students and their families, though, pay for a college education in this time of limited resources and costs? And costs rising. Where will the institutions get the money to upgrade their technology and accommodate the increased demand for post-secondary education opportunities to take advantage of all this wonderful future? How much can we ask of taxpayers to foot the bill for improvements and expansions at public institutions? The answer to these questions and others lies in part with the world of for-profit education, I believe. The growing use and acceptance of private investment capital is the sixth of the seven major trends affecting higher education that I'd like to talk about today. For-profit education is an idea whose time has come and which is achieving growing acceptance among policymakers and educational thinkers. Even in the past 3 to 4 years, as these trends that I've been talking about have taken hold, there's been a shift in the attitude toward for-profit education. DeVry was the first undergraduate and post-baccalaureate degree-granting higher education system to go public, as Jack mentioned, with his kind help back in 1991. But in the past 6 years alone, post-secondary education companies have raised more than $3.4 billion in equity capital through 38 IPOs and 30 follow-on offerings just in the last 6 years, and it's until recently been accelerating. Keller Graduate School of Management in 1977 became the first for-profit institution to earn accreditation by the Commission on Institutions of Higher Education for the North Central Association of Colleges and Schools. That was 1977, and now there are 25 for-profit institutions accredited by the North Central Commission, and dozens more by the other five regional accrediting associations in the United States. Merrill Lynch calls the education industry, quote, "the final frontier in private participation in public programs," unquote. And quite frankly, it's not just the access for-profit institutions have to capital to purchase sophisticated technology and build new facilities. By and large, for-profit institutions of higher education have also been quicker to recognize the changing higher education needs of students and of society. As Marilyn says, quote, the clear push from employers demanding relevant skills and the pull from employees seeking better jobs has created a fertile growth environment for proprietary post-secondary providers, unquote. So while adults over the age of 25 represent more than half of the post-secondary education market, most colleges and universities are still set up to serve the traditional student entering college pretty much right out of high school, someone who's looking for a broad general education and a taste of campus life. And again, quoting Merrill Lynch, quote, the lack of convenient education options translates to opportunity for innovative proprietary post-secondary institutions that can provide a no-nonsense and customer-oriented education model, which is efficient, convenient, accessible, and relevant in today's world, unquote. Even the more traditional higher educations are starting to explore the for-profit world. Here in New York University recently established a for-profit subsidiary, NYU Online, Inc., to lead its distance learning division. The seventh and final trend affecting higher education relates again to demographics, specifically the increasing ethnic and cultural diversity of our population. It's projected that by the year 2050, minorities will make up 40% of our population, up from 23% in 1990. Most of the growth in the minority population of the country will be among Hispanics, who will then make up an estimated 20% of our population. Given the historical income disparities between whites and non-whites in this country, access to technology also becomes a critical issue in education, both K-12 and post-secondary. This income disparity has given rise to the earlier mentioned digital divide. And while people define this issue in different ways, and some insist that the marketplace will take care of it as the cost of PCs and internet access comes down, the digital divide has indeed been placed on the national agenda. The digital divide suggests that higher education institutions should reach out to proactively reach out to minorities in poorer neighborhoods to make sure they have equal access to educational opportunities. It may also mean that post-secondary institutions have a responsibility to partner with or even compete with elementary and secondary education systems to motivate them and assist them in closing this digital divide. Given these seven trends shaping the world of higher education, what will the successful and relevant university of the future look like? Well, whether a university is funded by public dollars, eleemosynary dollars, or private investment capital, its future success will depend to a great extent on its ability to adapt to the changes being brought about by the trends that I just talked about. In the new century, educational systems must fully embrace these factors and the changing profile of the student population. They must break down the walls that have limited traditional universities and incorporate a stronger focus on career-oriented or economically driven education, on extensive teaching of new technologies, and on a commitment to be more responsive to the needs of their customers. The successful university of the future will probably possess most or all of the following characteristics. Will have the ability to update its curriculum quickly to meet the changing needs of students, employers, and all of society. It will be more accountable to students, viewing them as valued clients. As a result of this more customer-focused approach, the University of the Future will be more flexible in how and when and where it provides learning opportunities. It will accommodate the needs of non-traditional students who may be older and need to work while earning an undergraduate or graduate degree. These non-traditional learners will also need more convenient access to their education, whether that's online or in an expanded number of physical locations or both. Learning will be year-round. Degrees will be offered in part or completely through online education, depending on the amount of hands-on work required. The University of the Future will have the financial resources to purchase sophisticated technology and both expand and upgrade facilities to accommodate the growing number of students seeking all post-secondary education, and especially economically driven or economically advantageous to them post-secondary education. The successful University of the Future will be focused on preparing students for full citizenship in the information society and the knowledge economy. This means providing both the critical thinking skills and the applied learning that will be needed to succeed in a technology-based workplace. The University of the Future must also have the social and educational structure to support diverse races and ethnicities. While it may be true that computer literacy is the second language of the new economy, educational institutions may need to provide transition instruction in other languages. And post-secondary education will need to collaborate and involve itself with elementary and secondary education to ensure that all students have the grounding and the grounding in technology needed to succeed not only in college but in life. Are we ready for the future in higher education? Well, I believe that we are. The American university is already changing, and the transition to the University of the Future is underway. The change is being driven by our customers, students, and the businesses that need employees with highly developed skills and analytical thinking in order to survive themselves as companies and business organizations and non-business organizations in the knowledge economy. While there will always be, I believe, an important need and role for liberal arts education, and while research will always be a core function at some universities, there's a growing understanding that the concept of a university also encompasses a practical mission, one that serves a broad public need, an economic need. Professor Charles Anderson of the University of Wisconsin has written an essay on the purpose of the university called, quote, "Prescribing the Life of the Mind." Professor Anderson observes that students say their primary reason for going to college is to prepare for a career. He says, and I quote now, "Perhaps the development and transmission of useful skills is the basic public purpose of the university," unquote. And finally, I'd like to bring the discussion back to one of my very favorite topics, DeVry. In explaining his policy of trading away draft choices for seasoned veterans, pro football coach George Allen was famous for saying, "The future is now." So at DeVry, we believe the university of the future is now. DeVry's concept for the university of the future has both created and grown out of our company's core characteristics and beliefs. We have a profound concern for the priorities of our students. We understand that they desire a career-focused education with convenience and flexibility. Our students are offered year-round classes, and at the undergraduate level, they can choose to take their courses in the morning, the afternoon, the evenings, or on weekends, and stay within those guidelines so that they can work and do other things on a regular schedule in other parts of the day. Full-time students can earn a bachelor's degree in as little as 3 years year-round, and remember, that's 9 semesters, 4.5 academic years, but it's only 3 calendar years. We have a keen understanding of the needs of American businesses for skilled and well-educated technology-based employees. Each of our DeVry institutes has an advisory board of local industry leaders to help keep us on track when it comes to meeting the needs of employers. We anticipate trends and attempt to adapt quickly to them. For example, 2 years ago, we began to offer our master's degree programs online. And this semester, we have begun to offer our undergraduate coursework online. We are committed to lifelong learning. Adult students already represent almost half of our student population at the DeVry Institutes, the undergraduate system, and almost all of the students, of course, at Keller Graduate School of Management and Becker Konvisor CPA Review. We have a commitment to meet the needs of diverse students. DeVry is a leader in providing post-secondary education to minority students in all categories, who now make up about 45% of the student body at the DeVry Institutes, roughly twice the representation in higher education as a whole. Something that is important to me and is not exactly about the University of the Future is the way that I would like to close, and then maybe we can have some questions and some comments. There's a connection, because hopefully post-secondary education can be a force for good in helping us change this, but, and I know you all know this, nonetheless, I can't stress it enough, by age 19, only about 76% of Americans have graduated from high school, and some of those who have graduated cannot read or write. 20% plus of America's young adults are simply not equipped to participate at age 19. Solving this is crucial to the future of our nation and the world. So I thank you very much for the opportunity to speak, and I'd like to talk to you.
Some 15 years ago, Manhattan Institute started the movement towards school choice in this hall, which was a big success. And part of the success was to make other schools shape up, which was the case now of choice. How come your success has not had any impact on the college, public or private, it hasn't been shape up?
Well, no.
I have people from traditional education come up to me all the time and say, "You stinker. You are making us change, but it's probably good for us."
I think you're wrong. I think that we have had an effect on higher education. Everything you said sounds very democratic. I think I need to lean on this, but my experience for many years as a professor and teacher has been that speaking of students' needs and priorities inevitably turns out standards for education. Students have reformed those schools in recent years. One reason kids are graduating now, taking 5 years to graduate from high school or 6 years to graduate from high school, is that they know there are no penalties for not making it any faster. I think that when you, I'm just wondering how your program would be any better when your students are basically customers. And customers, they have their own needs, and I think you overestimate the amount of work people do will do when they are paying for something that they think they should, you know, they're your customer.
The discipline, I understand that. Do you have more?
The
discipline on us as a system on DeVry University is that we have two customers. This customer is paying and wants a good job at the end. This customer is hiring and won't keep hiring at 96% unless these people can do it when they get there. So our standards are crystal clear. Students know. Sometimes they come in thinking, if I just show up, I'll get a C and I'll pass. They don't. They flunk out. And we try so hard to save them, but sometimes when you're 18, you have to, you have to get hit by a 2x4 a couple times before you're ready to believe, and so they do flunk out. Sometimes they come back. We try to get them to come back if they can do it. But the discipline is dual. It is that what the student wants and needs, that's the customer, and what the market for graduates wants and needs, that's a really important customer. We know crystal clear, that if instead of 96% hired, it was 96% not hired, we would not have any students. And so we cannot afford to give students what they want if what they want is not what's right.
Could you say a few words about your teaching staff, the profile of your teaching staff? How is it different from the not-for-profit? Their incomes, and are they enough? Is there enough of a pool of people to draw from for the teaching staff of the future?
Go in reverse order. I think there is enough of a pool because for our faculty, we look for people with advanced degrees, but we also look for people who have experience in the fields they're going to teach. And often when a person has been working for 8 or 10 years in a technical way, especially, that person says, well, what do I want to do now? Do I want to be a manager? Do I want to be a senior scientist or technical person or engineer? Or do I want to do something else like teach? And we look for those people. We reach out to them, and we have had good success in bringing them into our university. Salary range from low to high in the university for full-time people is from low 30s to, I think, our highest paid faculty are $125,000 or so. So it's a fairly wide range, but we have a lot of continuity. We have only a 7% turnover in the faculty, so they stay a long time and they come up in pay. The profile of the faculty, I think I've kind of answered that. Advanced degrees, many have PhDs, some write books, but they write books outside of their core teaching mission because they know what they're being paid for by DeVry University is student teaching.
Related question, that's what do you think the pros and cons are of academic tenure among faculty, and what role do you see for
Well, I simply, we don't, around DeVry, we don't think or talk about tenure very much. We don't have it, and we don't think it's an integral part of the model for the future.
I'm very struck by the implementation of consumer knowledge because it's incredibly useful that students have, and they need access to my ideas, those ideas are amazing, our economies are powerful. Well, obviously, human liberalism is one of the ideas that they need access to. And for generations of Americans who have bought and distinguished general education that has transmitted such powerful ideas as these. You mentioned, despite your career and orientation in the line of organization, that you do provide general education. I'm very interested in that, actually, in some depth, some topics. Whether you have associate degrees or some X amount of general ed, or do you have bachelor's degree, how much, what do you do, content, is it also programmatic, do you repeat the time?
That's, I hope it is. We work on making it. It's about one-third of our curriculum. Two-thirds is science and technology and engineering and math. and one-third is general education. And we, our gen ed faculty are always saying, oh, you don't love us, you just love those damn engineers and sciences. And we say, we do love you, and what you do is enormously important. And our name is Institute of Technology, that's true, but general education is a very important part, and we work very hard to make sure that that it will always be an important part. We have one associate degree program for electronics technicians that has a lower than one-third component of general education because it is a five-semester degree, but all the rest of our programs are all baccalaureate. We're dominantly baccalaureate, and it's about one-third.
Do you have a loan program?
We do. We have not only access for students to all of the state and federal and some private loan programs around the country, we have a DeVry loan program, and it's a last dollar loan program. If we help a student, when we help a student get all the aid, scholarship, and loan aid that he or she is eligible for, which we routinely do with every student, if there's still a gap, we say, we'll fill that gap. We have a credit card called an EduCard that we give to every student when they're admitted. And incidentally, just out of interest, we find that about 20% of the students who come to us should not start DeVry, and we're here in New York, we literally pack them across the street and say, go see the folks at LaGuardia Community College and show them these test results, because we test at no charge with a test done for us by Educational Testing Service, an online test, and show them these results that we share with you and strengthen yourself and then come back, because they're very good at that. That means part of their business, their mission is developmental education. So anyway, the 80% that we're talking about. I had something else I wanted to say, but it left my mind. Shouldn't have given you the aside. Maybe ask it again later.
What about the gargantuan market abroad? You're in 35 countries, but how big is it really, the percentage, and where's it going?
We're in 35 countries, but only in our CPA business. When Jack said that one half of the world's new CPAs every year come through Becker Kahnweiser CPA review, that's a true statement. That happens in 35 countries. DeVry University operates only in two countries, U.S. and Canada. We are driven to spread our service to any and every place that needs us, but first we are we're just working so hard to deepen and strengthen ourselves in the U.S. and Canada to have the strongest possible base from which to reach out everywhere else with DeVry University, that it will probably be a few years, although our wonderful neighbor of the South is represented here today, and I'm excited to, there he is, the Consul General, and I'm excited to think that before too long that we'll be as good as NAFTA. We'll be in all three places.
I was impressed with something like 21 return or increase in price of stock was offering that. I wondered a bit about how you manage the business. In particular, is that stock price result of increasing profit margins? If so, what are you doing to increase your profit margins?
Part of that is increasing profit margins because our model calls for the development of wonderful central services and curriculum development. We use the whole faculty for curriculum development. We coordinated centrally, and we coordinate a lot of things centrally to serve the campuses. So that central overhead doesn't go up as fast as the number of students go up, and as a result, our pre-tax margins, which are in the 15% range right now, pre-tax, go up about 50 basis points, about 0.5% a year. And as we look forward, people have asked us, well, you know, do you think you can do that for the next 5 or 10 years? And we say, well, as we look forward, who can say, but we see no no diminution or end to that roughly 40, 50, 60 basis point a year improvement in margins, at least up into the high teens, 20% range. So beyond that, we'll know more when we get closer to it. But primarily, it is that stock price increase is driven by two things: profit increases, which have never been below our low in the 9 years we've been public. I'm proud to say is 22% annual increase. That's our low, and the rest were above that. Matter of fact, and so as Yogi Berra would say, and the other thing is that as investors have looked at us and said, what will their earnings look like if they do this for another 9 years? They have bid our PE multiple up to the point where it's now about 40 on trailing earnings. Well, our approach is that's another group. We have at least one, usually two or three librarians on every campus, and they say, just like the Gen Ed faculty, oh, you don't love us, you have all this online database stuff and terminals all over the school, and students don't love us. And we say, we do love you. Libraries are really important. You teach students how to access those. We do have book collections on every campus that we constantly weed and we throw away, just like other libraries throw away. Our libraries are in the 10,000 to 30,000 volume range, so they're not big libraries, but they're technical libraries. And also, we do take it very seriously that part of the job of the library and the librarian is to teach our students to be good online data gatherers and researchers. Set up model schedules, and by and large, unless a student needs a wildly special schedule, they can have all their classes before lunch, all their classes after lunch and before dinner, or all their classes after dinner. It's not rocket science, but come and we'll show you. The answer is beyond my understanding, because we have wizards who do this. They keep telling me, we're getting more special schedules, it's getting harder, but they keep doing it.
If the major universities are going to go into the online college campuses, how do you think that will affect you?
Come on in, the water's fine. We love it. First of all, we only have, compared to the 80,000 in-person students today, a small number of online students. But we're thrilled by the fact that we can responsibly, we believe, grow our online much faster than we can responsibly grow our campuses. You need so much infrastructure on a campus. We're comfortable. Our top line grows about 20% a year, but part of that is tuition increases. So our students grow mid-teens in terms of annual percentage growth, which doesn't sound like a lot of growth if you're a dot-com company. But if you ask any other university, what would it be? How would you like it if you had to double your student body with improving quality every 5 years? That's about all we can responsibly do. But in online, even though we limit our class sizes to 20 students in online, 20 students and a faculty member that makes an online course, and we limit the in-person graduate courses, which is the way we started this, to 30 in person, because we find that 30 works if they're all in one room. But in online, where a lot of the interaction between the teacher and the student has to be electronic and individual, and it's more time consuming in some ways for the teacher, 20 is the max. Nonetheless, that can grow responsibly a lot faster than 15% a year.
How will online education affect property values?
Second one is easy. We help them get their part-time jobs. Our students, by and large, are from middle-income or families or below middle-income families, and so 85% of them have part-time jobs in concert with their education to help pay for college. That's easy. The first question was, what about margins in online? Our biggest cost, we have nice facilities, better than nice facilities, I think. You know something about that, purchasing the real estate business, and helped us with some of our facilities. But the biggest cost in DeVry University is people. And so you figured out, if you can only have 20 students in an online class, and if the teachers, by and large, think they work harder, and that's probably because it's early and, you know, it's still developing. They work harder to teach an online course than they work to teach an in-person course. So we charge a little more tuition for online.
Jack, I can't resist. Colors behind you.
I know you're good.
Your criteria, Harvard will not be a university. There's no chance that they're going to change their $13 billion endowment.
They can last a long time.
They have 10 children. They do really focus on the students. They just assume if you go to Harvard, you get a good job. When we get them from Harvard, all of Harvard business school, we have to be crazy. They can't do anything.
Jack, I was going to tease, but let me think of it. Let me try to answer this seriously. What the experience for an 18 to 22 year old includes when he or she goes to college is socialization, is mentoring, is eye-opening. It takes place as much outside the classroom or more than inside the classroom. It takes place with special relationships that I think back to with two or three of my teachers over 4 years at Princeton, and all of that, you know, unless somehow the emperor burns his clothes and ends up with no clothes, which I don't think Harvard will do. I think you'll still have a fantastic faculty, and because of the 350 years of history, you will have people who want to go there, and the best and the brightest will apply to Harvard, and they will go for 4 years, and they will grow up, which is another big thing one does from 18 to 22, and hopefully they will come out of there with a concept of service to their fellow human beings that matches the highest ideals that humans have been able to reach for over the years, and they'll come out with the capacity to really help in extraordinary ways. All right, I'm apologize.
I thank you, and I'm sure the Harvard Club thanks you also. So.